So we can continue with FICE. Annual.
Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon, everybody. Agenda paper 5. Only one paper for you this time, which is a direct follow-on from last month. We haven't provided the cover note that we usually provide because we're just trying to tie up this this loose end from last month. Next time we come to the board, we'll give you the updated cover letter, cover notes, and as part of that, we hope we can include a more detailed kind of roadmap of the remaining topics that we plan to take to the board in the future, because after we conclude this issue today, then we can I think we've completed a large part of the basic framework of the discussions. We still have some very difficult issues to deal with in terms of derivatives that we hope this framework is going to help us do. So we can paint that picture for you at the next meeting. So this paper, as I mentioned, is a direct follow-on from last month. In April, we discussed different ways to attribute changes in net assets, so profit or loss and other comprehensive income, to classes of equity other than ordinary shares. As we mentioned back in February, we think attribution will be a useful tool. It will provide useful information, and it will also help to alleviate some of the polarized consequences of the classification decision. So regardless of whether you classify these instruments as liabilities or equity, we're still going to provide some information, and we narrow that gap that exists today. At the meeting in April, the board decided that it would be useful and cost-effective to base the attribution for non-derivatives on the existing requirements of IAS 33, earnings per share. And for derivatives in particular, we explored three approaches. Approach A was the status quo, which is no attribution is performed for derivative equity instruments. Approach B was based on fair value, which again, just as a reminder, is what we illustrated in the discussion paper on the conceptual framework, and would also result in the same information as if the instruments were classified as a liability. And so it would be similar to a narrow equity approach, or the same information would be provided as a narrow equity approach. Again, we noted the consequences of the full fair value approach, approach B, in particular the results from incomplete recognition and mixed measurement of the entity's assets. To alleviate those consequences, we mapped out approach C, which was a modification to the full fair value approach, which focused on getting the recognized carrying amounts of different classes of equity, of derivatives in particular, and ordinary shares, to reflect their relative fair values. During that meeting, the board suggested an alternative way to do the attribution that was different to approach C, would also alleviate some of the concerns about the full fair value method, but would do it in a slightly different way. The board also asked us to consider how we might limit the potential approaches that we might include in the discussion paper, or to organize them in a way that didn't look like we were including all possible permutations of these types of calculations. So in paragraphs 10 to 19, we illustrate the approach that was suggested by the board, which we call approach D, and compare it to approach C. Importantly, we note that the objectives of the approaches are quite different. Approach C focuses on the stocks at the end of the period, so the carrying values at the end of the period, and looks to allocate the carrying values on a relative fair value basis, whereas approach D focuses on the flows during the period, and it looks to allocate the profit or loss and other comprehensive income based on average fair values during the period. Both alleviate the consequences of the full fair value approach, but again, they're no silver bullet. They both have their individual consequences because they're modifications to a direct measurement base. In paragraphs 20 to 22, we just set out which approaches we think the discussion paper should include. In our view, we think the discussion paper should at least include the full fair value approach. Even if the board does not select that approach as its preliminary view, I think it's important that we set it out and the reasons why it wasn't chosen. I think this is because we've received enough responses from users advocating a narrow equity type of approach that I think we should just air it out and lay out. If we do decide to go for it as a preliminary review, we can say why that is the case. But importantly, if we don't decide to adopt that as the preliminary review, we can just set out the consequences and why we've reached that conclusion. For approaches C and D, we don't think that we need to include both of them in detail in the discussion paper. If the board does not select one of these approaches as its preliminary review, we think it would be sufficient just to include one in terms of the objective of the modification, whether the focus should be on the carrying amounts or the flows during the year. And we think that it would be sufficient focusing on one to just illustrate the advantages and disadvantages of this type of calculation approach. And say for approach D, we could just set out what the calculation might be, say in an appendix, or if we want to go that far. So we've structured the questions for the board, first asking you if you'd like to form a preliminary review, and if so, which approach you'd like to select. And then the follow-up questions depend on which one you select, and if you didn't select one of these, we ask whether you would agree to include the full fair value approach in the discussion paper as we suggest, and also if you don't select C or D, whether you agree that we only include one of those two approaches. So with that, I'll just turn it over to the board for comments, questions.
Martin?
I have to say I'm really struggling with two former view on that, because when I'm thinking about the example, there is a warrant which is an equity instrument, it's not a derivative to P&L, which is maybe exercisable in 5 years' time. And now we're proposing really to give information what is the profit attribution for this warrant, which may be exercised in 5 years or not, nobody knows, for current year's profit attribution. And we proposing that then preparers have to fair value then this equity instrument, which has not to be fair valued currently because it is not a derivative. If it is not a listed company, they have to fair value the whole company, because if they want to do this allocation, doing all that work for an information which is in profit attribution for an instrument which is, and that is my struggle in. What is the information value for that? Because it is really not exercised now, it is exercisable in 5 years' time, and why do all this kind of effort that maybe investor can, if it was exercised, what is maybe then in kind of profit attribution to this kind of instrument? What is this information value more than we have in kind of what we currently have as diluted earnings per share? Because that is a kind of, if it all is exercised, okay, maybe what is the kind of earnings attribution for this type. And I'm really struggling with this new concept, why doing all this kind of stuff, and what is really the benefit. There's a lot of cost, but I don't see really the additional benefit.
Okay, do you want me to respond to that? So the basic idea of doing the attribution is so that all of the effects of these other equity claims are presented in the one place. At the moment, some of them are taken into account in basic earnings per share. Some of them are taken into account in diluted earnings per share. There's no requirement to recognize any of these changes, and so they're just presented as calculations. And one of the approaches is just to keep that status quo and just say, okay, that we can deal with the information deficit by providing additional disclosures, and we're yet to think about how we might reduce that deficit through disclosure. The point about the attribution and why it might be more relevant is even though these instruments are not issued equity instruments, they're a claim against the entity. And because they have some optionality, that changes the distribution of returns for...
Maybe.
Well, it does in a way. So if a user is looking to buy or sell or hold its equity, ordinary shares, for instance, then it will have to take into account the effect of the warrants on the prospects for future cash flows. No.
But you said it will, but it isn't still an option.
It's an option, but it's still a claim against the entity.
And so there's an economic assumption that the more in the money it is, the more likely it will be exercised. The same side, if it is not exercised, is actually a transfer of wealth the other way.
Yeah, but my main point, if you have, let's assume you have 15 of these instruments, some is exercisable in 15 years, maybe one next year, one out of the money, one in of the money, then you have presented all in one number. And I would think the information value of that is zero, is close to zero. And I think really the preferable approach, that is my point, is to approach A, do nothing with that, and then additional disclosure. Because to really get valuable information, I cannot see without the detailed information about the specific instrument.
And mixing all this up in one number and do a lot of fair value calculations and mixing all, I don't see really what people are doing with that. With this number, I would not have any idea.
That's true, Martin, but I think we have received the views from a lot of users that have told us that they prefer a narrow definition of equity that just focuses on ordinary shares. Precisely so, all of these effects are taken into account. It might be the case that if they see the consequences of that, and including all the consequences about full fair value or whatever, they might not want that anymore. But I think
I agree. But narrow if you have this narrow equity, then you should classify this instrument as liabilities. But I think that is not what we're doing. That because we're deciding it's an equity instrument, but then do something which I agree, maybe more information value. But I'm convinced it can only do with more information about disclosure of the specific. Specific terms of this kind of instrument. And I don't know why, what I really want to say, I don't know what is the additional value compared to what we currently have as diluted earnings per share. Maybe it is a little bit more precise, maybe, but is it really cost benefit? Is that worth it? That is my main concern.
Yeah.
Carol?
So I'm struggling with the answers before perhaps a subset of where Martin's getting to. For me, I think there is a clear transfer of value happening between different classes of equity here, and the value of expressing that transfer in some kind of more obvious way seems very apparent to me. So I think we can get value out of expressing it. I think a lot of what happens in diluted headline earnings is sort of lost from sight in terms of understanding what's happened in a particular year. I am concerned that if we go down an approach of approach B, that has the potential to be even more misunderstood because of that effect that it's only reflecting a part of what's actually happening in the underlying business. So I would prefer to be in the space of either C or D. The difficulty with C or D is that I see both of them as having fairly significant strengths and fairly significant weaknesses. To the point that Martin was making, I think given the fact that we are portraying information that I would consider to be really valuable, I think we should be testing these at least to get an understanding of the practicality and how people could go about doing it, and etc. My inclination would be then to test, to put B on the table, because I think it helps people understand the process. And then I'm kind of leaning towards C, but I'm finding it quite hard to articulate why I prefer C to D, and it's probably because I think that the balance sheet value, the value on balance sheet, is likely to guide people more in understanding what the eventual outcome is going to be. But I've changed my mind three times while I was listening on that. So.
Okay. I'm struggling to get my head around what I do and don't like, so maybe a few observations. I think I know where I land, but I'm not sure how helpful I'm going to be. I guess I have similar concerns to some of the concerns that Martin raised, and I feel like if we look at something like puts on non-controlling interests, which have been so difficult and controversial, I feel that a lot of the tension that we get there is because we've sort of got a clash of two worlds. One is a fair value measurement world clashing with a mixed measurement world, where if you start to have an effect in terms of a P&L effect on changes in the value of your shares and it comes up against P&L, suddenly people think it's counterintuitive. And I worry a little bit that all of these approaches, which are to some extent focusing on what the fair value of derivatives are and then doing something in terms of attribution of profit, bring some of those tensions in another form. And I worry about whether or not the benefits of the extra information justify the sort of cost and concerns that sort of counterintuitive effect is that people are going to have. Having said all of that, if the purpose of a discussion paper is really to give us a means to sort of facilitate understanding and discussion, then maybe if we were to put something, one of these approaches in, not saying that we think this is the best idea in the world, but to facilitate a more precise conversation with investors and users in particular about, okay, we could take it with this approach, we think it gives this information, is that useful information to you, how would you use it, rather than it being such an abstract conversation. Maybe that's a helpful thing. So maybe if we could put more of a flag in of this is an idea to facilitate discussion rather than this is what the board thinks is a great idea and therefore we're convinced on the benefits outweighing costs, just to protect us a little bit, I think that would be helpful. If I then had to choose between the three different approaches, I think on balance I understand the information content most coming out of approach D, probably because its logic's most similar to diluted EPS thinking, if I understand it correctly, but with refinement because it's looking at the total fair value as opposed to just the intrinsic value. So it's picking up the time value effects as well. So it's sort of it's a better measure of what diluted EPS is trying to capture for these types of instruments. And I guess then my only hesitation would be that while I understand the logic better, rather than sort of trying to pin to bits of the balance sheet being measured, or sorry, bits of equity being measured at fair value and others not, or sort of having some sort of relative remeasurement, which I struggle with a bit more conceptually. I think the thing I still struggle with, even though I could explain to somebody what I think approach D tells me in terms of information content, is whether that extra information really warrants the sort of elevation that you get by making it an attribution as opposed to a more refined EPS measure, which would be the other thing we could do with it. We could say let's do EPS better, rather than saying let's go the full step of attribution with all of the concerns it might raise about this sort of clash of fair value and exclusion. So if I had to choose, I'd say approach D with a sort of information gathering mode attached to it as one of the reasons for doing that.
So instead of a preliminary view, just set it out there as one of the ways that might alleviate the deficit of information or perceived deficit that users have, and then have a discussion.
Peter wants to.
Philippe?
As a follow-up of that, I have a question for the staff. If we were to propose approach D, would that come as a replacement of IAS 33? And then we will have to drop IAS 33 requirements, or will it come on top of it, hence adding to the disclosure overload and complexity and cost of applying the standards, etc. Because as a replacement of IAS 33, I'm not sure it is really more complex to do, except for the fair value calculations. But if it provides better information at a relatively moderate additional cost as compared to IAS 33, let's test the idea and let's discuss it. I'm not sure it will fly, but at least it's on a discussion paper, so we can try to get feedback. But if we were to say it comes on top of IAS 33, then I think forget it.
Well, I think we'd probably have to say that if the board does do approach D, we'd have to think quite carefully about the consequences for IAS 33. Now, the question is, if we're just putting it out there as an idea that we're going to be testing, we can just map that out and let people know that we understand that there's an interaction between the two, and we wouldn't want to impose both calculations on people because they're so similar. And so we can take that into account if we want to go forward and when we're talking to people about it. But I agree that's one of the consequences of approach D is it's because of its similarity to IS-33. Do we need both?
Mary,
if we, I'll give the punchline and then explain how I get there. I think we should not express. I would like to not express a preliminary view in the discussion paper about what where we go. I think if we step back. We do have a different preliminary view parked a long time ago in our discussion on this project, which is we are going to look at cleaning up and organizing and underpinning the conclusions captured by IS-32 rather than throwing it out the window. But I, and starting again with a clean sheet of paper. And I think to be fair to users who have provided us input in this area, we have to, in the discussion paper, say, our preliminary view is that we're doing that rather than a fundamental reconsideration. When users have said we want to fundamental, at least some users have said fundamental reconsideration, narrowing to a narrow approach to equity, with the consequence that all these other things would be, I think they're assuming all these other things would be classified as liability and therefore changes in their value would be recognized and would be recognized through the statement of financial performance. So I think that's the preliminary view that we have, and therefore we go on to say, so we're looking to try and identify what the information needs of users were that we are trying to provide in alternative ways. And then I would say one approach, Martin said A, I think what goes along with A is we could say, but requiring publication of the workings of the earnings per share calculation it is now, with or without tweaks, because right now you get it, you might get some snippets, but I think it's in some of the actual detail of the calculations that more sophisticated users can get some of the dilution quantification, however approximate, that they may not be able to see now. They can get that, but they can't see. But I think we put A out there. And then I think we say, or we can try and show it in an expanded statement of equity, and then say the question that we face. And I really had an aha moment looking at paper 5 on page 6, is either by focusing on trying to improve the allocation of the net assets to show the relative claims, and or we can do it by trying to show the allocation of the statement of financial performance, that being profit or loss plus OCI, to the various claims. And the aha moment I had is if you look at page 6. If you look at the end of approach D, which is at the top of that page, you see it's taking, the last few lines are taking total income and expense and then attributing it based on relative fair value. Versus approach C, which is reproduced below, it's taking net assets at the end of the period and attributing those based on relative fair value. And so I think instead of picking one, we should say, here's the question we're facing. Now, if we were to do this approach, we could do it along the line. If we were to do the allocation of income, it could be along the lines of D. If we were to do the allocation of net assets, it could be along the lines of C. And I'm ignoring B for the moment, just because it isn't in front of us. But I'm not so fussed about which one. I don't want this to be about picking which one. I think it's about asking the question, do we do it via showing an allocation? And if we do, should we be focusing on net assets or should we be focusing on statement of financial performance? And then I would raise the fact that most of the ways we've been discussing have been based on relative fair values. Yeah. And that raises cost questions and kind of asking, does anybody see any other meaningful method of attributing, raising those cost benefit issues? And maybe one thing that when Sue was commenting, I think it was Sue about earnings, maybe it was Sue, maybe it was somebody else about earnings per share, maybe we should even ask the dread question about intrinsic value. It isn't perfect, but it's less costly. And so we approach it that way. So I'd say let's not form a preliminary view. And by the way, if we are discussing approach B, let's not call it a full fair value approach because it will send an incorrect message that we're introducing full fair value measurement of all claims, and you're really just talking about that
just
as
the derivatives.
A denominator for allocation,
yeah.
or basis for allocation. So let's focus on the communication.
Yeah.
And I think it would be actually harmful to our calls to form a preliminary views, because we'll get people reacting to specifics as opposed to articulating whether they think this is useful information or not and how they would use it.
Yeah.
So, long list of thoughts.
Thank you. I agree with Mary's point and Martin's information value. I guess you better suggest some kind of concrete kind of framework for this. Just what is the purpose of the disinformation? So if we can provide such kind of framework, mini framework, then we might easy, maybe better, in better position to choose which one is better.
Yeah.
So the last month your paper, you suggested that this is a kind of a one solution to alleviate the, some kind of a weakness of a gamma model. That purpose, and we are talking about the income statement approach and balance sheet approach, is confusing. So there, it seems to me, if we think about the performance, then maybe approach D might be better, because it consists of the EPS calculation and there's a flow in the measure set. But if we think some kind of a dividends, some kind of dividends expense, like the interest expense in the debt, then if we think that way, then maybe we should think about the other way. Maybe the balanced approach, stock approach might be better,
yeah.
Like the non-control interest and the ordinary shareholder, the attribution. Or if we just finish the share-based payment project here, if we think that kind of thing, then we should, if we can measure stock option at a fair value, then we can resolve some issues in the grant gate, fair value measurement model. So there are many difficult issues related to this one. So the most important thing is what your purpose specifically, to solve by this kind of approach. That would be a really important thing, I guess. So I suggest clarify that.
Thank you. Although I have a similar concern that Martin raised, let's forget about approach A for the moment, and let's compare approach B and C or D. Although it looks like a technical issue, I think there is a big conceptual difference between approach B and C and D. The question is whether or not we treat a warrant holder as an enemy or friend of shareholders. So if we treat warrant holder as enemy of shareholder, like a debt holder, then we should go to approach B. But if you treat a warrant holder as a common destiny with the same boat, because they are exposed to the same share price risk, so then we can use approach C or D. The question is whether or not warrant holder is enemy or friends. But actually, warrant holder is not a shareholder yet. They are just a future shareholder. So this makes a big difference. If we treat future shareholder as if it were a current shareholder, it will totally destroy the concept of financial statements. Therefore, I don't think approach C or D would work. So, just for the second, and therefore I think the C and D should be off the table. Then the question is whether or not we should go to B or approach A. And if we go to approach B, as Manuel pointed out, it has lots of disadvantage because it will amplify the consequence of incomplete recognition. So you say it's a disadvantage. However, I don't think it's a disadvantage. This is what the financial statement is all about. We can show it, all the incompleteness in the equity, because equity is a residual. So I think I don't think it's a disadvantage. It is rather advantage of approach B. Because this is the FICE project, not the disclosure project, so if you write the discussion paper, I think you should focus on approach B rather than approach A.
Yeah.
Just a couple of points, Tuck. I think I'll take the last one first, just on the fair value and the disadvantages of that. I think some of the users that we speak to, which are also quite sophisticated, they actually want to see these, and they're not kind of perturbed about, you know, these consequences, and they know how to deal with it. They understand quite well what the change represents, and they're just purely using that to put it in their models and perform their analysis. But I guess if you just look at the picture of the primary financial statements intuitively, it doesn't. Yeah, I can understand where some people have concerns. But just on the point about them being future shareholders, I think there's a difference between a warrant holder and someone who's going to invest in the future on a fair value basis by, you know, accepting some kind of new IPO in the future. Mm-hmm. The warrant holder has a present claim against the entity, and their claim is different to the ordinary shareholder. I mean, sure, there's some conversion option, but then we have all these, we have the effect of optionality with convertible bonds as well. So we're not only thinking about, for instance, the warrant holder, we could be thinking about, for instance, components of convertible bonds as well. So I think we need to think of them as a claim holder against the entity at the reporting day, and seeing how their rights or the entity's obligations in terms of how they're going to be satisfying those obligations in the future by issuing shares, or perhaps by settling the warrant by paying cash. They could do that as well. And in that case, the outcome's the same as a cash settled warrant. So we need to think of them as a claim
but
holder.
But to me, the big difference is between the whether or not you are current shareholder or future shareholder. Although they have some claims already, there are many other people who have a claim, like simple debt holders. And it is different from the future hypothetical shareholder. However, they are not yet the current shareholder. So that is the most important thing, the conceptual things, whether or not we stay on that, you know, current shareholder or not.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, okay, I understand. Yeah.
Pat. I like Tuck's analysis, and it was, as I was listening, it reminded me of a paper that one of our former colleagues wrote, Mary Barth. And interestingly, she sent it, I guess it's good 3 or 4 years ago. I don't know whether Peter remembers it or Stephen. I remember getting it around New Year's, and I read it, and it was so complex I put it away because this project was in abeyance at that point in time. But Mary's analysis actually, in very sophisticated terms, captures Tuck's comments. And she describes this friendliness or lack of friendliness in terms of whether or not warrants lever or de-lever the equity risk of common stock or of the firm. And I would commend that analysis to your attention, because I think that's the crux of the issue. Is this going to be classified as equity? Are we satisfied, or is it a liability? And there's analysis and research out there that goes both ways. Her analysis, I think, is leaning much more, as I understand it, towards an equity classification, in which case I'm a little bit agnostic, frankly, whether or not we're in C or D. Some of the ideas that Stephen proposed last month, if in fact it's going to be classified as equity, I'd be open to, but I was kind of initially in my thought process leaning more towards the classification as a liability, and hence that's why I wasn't really enamored with that. But ultimately, I think Tuck's right. It depends on how you're going to classify this thing, and the presentation attribution should follow, accordingly. Yeah. You know, whether you agree or disagree, there should be some consistency there. So I really like Mary's paper as I went back and looked at it, because it really lays out all the arguments of past research,
yep,
and her current arguments for whether or not this is a liability or equity, and then how you contribute.
We know Mary's paper, but I guess that's why we're under the gamma approach. That's mm-hmm. part of the reasons why we're classifying these things as equity, because they're exposed to the same kind of risks and returns. However, having said that, there is some differences there.
Yeah.
And the question is whether we want to display some of those differences. And part of the rationale for going to something like approach D is simply because, you know, some of these classifications can be quite difficult. You know, there's a lot of judgment involved. It would reduce the gap or the consequences of that judgment by requiring the same information. But I can completely understand why something like approach C or D would provide just as useful information.
Right.
Gary.
Thank you. And just a couple of actually process questions, Manuel, then to reconfirm something. All of the, whether you're B, C, or D here, this all affects basic earnings per share, not diluted. Is that still correct? I'd asked you that last month. Is that still accurate?
I think we'd still have to think about consequential amendments or the consequences to basic EPS. I probably wouldn't want to go there just yet, because, for instance, if we do go down approach B, we might want to treat things somewhat differently for basic EPS.
But this is affecting basic EPS the way you might be.
It would affect the numerator, wouldn't it?
Because at the moment the starting point is profit or loss from continuing operations, and we have a separate, we don't include OCI at the moment for the EPS calculations. So if it does, I have illustrated it as an effect to basic EPS, but I think we'd probably have to consider that separately, whether we want to carry that forward. We're not asking about any changes to EPS as part of this paper. We're just looking at the attribution.
That's affecting the numerator, though, is it not? B, C, and D have different net income available numbers for ordinary shares?
And you're saying earnings available to ordinary shareholders are X the attribution to this other category.
I guess the other way of answering that is, if we were to look at attribution, whether it's B, C, or D, the question could be, is this on the primary, on the face of the primary statements, or is this only to get to a starting point for, let's say, diluted? I mean, it's not something we've thought about or talked about before, but I think on its face, the answer to Gary's question is yes, unless we restricted this attribution to a more limited purpose than display on the primary financial statements.
Well, I think it's as written, it does affect primary EPS, both last month's papers and this. Yeah. But I was really trying to start with, it's only affecting primary. At this point, diluted is untouched by this. Is that still?
Because
I still have an opinion diluted is where the action is. Certainly in the Western side of the Atlantic, there's almost no attention on primary. Now, maybe that's not the case universally, you know, in here, maybe things can change. But if most of the attention is on diluted, you know, kind of ask yourself a question, what are we gaining in terms of information content putting it into basic? Because right now you have three different, you know, between this and last month's paper, you have four different cases ignoring A, which is this current status. You have three different sets of income available for ordinary shares, you know, when these are not shareholders today, as Tak, you know, pointed out, they may be. And then going on where Martin is, I mean, you might have many of these instruments, you know, some in the money, some out of the money, some immediately exercisable, some a decade out from being exercisable. Just reducing it down to one number, I don't know what sort of incremental information that really gets us out of this. For some that's complicated, which I think will come across as an academic allocation, you know, because they're dealing with average fair value, you've got different points in time in B, C, and D when you're measuring these things. So, I mean, I just don't know that we, you know, pass the cost-benefit test in terms of incremental information introduced. Then just the last question is, we're still pursuing the other elements of FICE, beta and gamma and stuff. This is just a subset of the larger project. And I would agree, if we went out with some or all these things, we probably should since not hearing warm and fuzziness towards any one of the models in here, you just put it out there as a, not as a preliminary view, it's just a discussion points without you know, judging on it.
Although I also have similar concern as Martin mentioned, but I will support to, you know, explore and you know, seek views from outsiders.
I have a simple question to Daryl and Sue. You know, Manuel suggests CND we should only expose one, and Mary seems, you know, propose we should discuss both because both have different directions. And Daryl said, you know, you see obvious pros and cons both, but you lenient to C, and Sue lenient to D. And Daryl, will you propose to expose both? Or
I would probably be more in favor of putting down both, but I think at the very least we should be expressing a preference for one or the other. I think we need to be giving some kind of guidance. But I think it might be useful for people to understand that there are two versions out here.
I thought that Mary's idea of sort of talking about what the drivers are and what the different sort of information it provided was quite a useful one and would probably facilitate discussions. But I'm not sure that I'd say we prefer one or another.
Amaru?
I was about to mention exactly my to Mary's idea. I think it's very wise. I wouldn't limit us to the status quo because at the end of the day, after a discussion paper and the feedback and deliberation, we can always stay where we are. So if we do agree, it's not doable. I think the ideas that staff brought to us and trying to capture what we asked you to do, it's an excellent starting point. As for approach themselves, if we follow Mary's ideas of exploring, and in the discussion paper will be a good opportunity for us to really somewhat test what is possible. I personally have lots of concerns on approach D, on the cost aspect and operationality. Because capturing the flows during the year, and particularly if you have a group with loads of instruments issued in different places, and this could be extremely difficult to make it operational in terms of considering cost and the meaningfulness of the information that could be produced under approach D in this situation. This is my main concern. So that said, I would have more sympathy to something similar to approach C between the two in terms of leaning, but basically because of the array of aspects.
Yeah, okay. Couple of comments. First of all, I think Mary put her finger on an important point, which is the objective to look at an attribution of the profit or loss for the year, or is it an attribution of the change in the net assets? Because I think they'll lead you in different directions, probably. And I think to try and answer that question, we'd want to know really what the users are going to do with the information. I said last month I was bothered about approach C. I'm equally bothered about approach D, because I can't see for either of them really exactly what they're trying to achieve or what kind of information they're providing. It seems to me that if we're going into attribution, what we're trying to do is we're looking at the profit or possibly the change in net assets and trying to account for the fact that some other class of equity holders might share in them at some point in the future. And so it seems, and they'll either exercise their warrants, let's say, or they'll not be exercised. So they'll end up either sharing or not sharing at some point in the future. And my concern with both approaches C and D is that they don't really focus on that kind of binary outcome. It's a kind of mixed approach, and it's also using averages over the time. So I find it very difficult to relate either of them to the what I see as the objective, which is to see how people might share in that allocation in the future if you're going to try and project it in some way. So I don't know how I'd do it, but I think if I did, the only things that have occurred to me would be either to I would look at the year-end position, I think, not some sort of averages during the year, because people will either share or they won't share. And one way to do it might be to say which ones are currently in the money and assume those are exercised and just include those. Or another would be some kind of potential dilution, looking at the worst case or something of that kind, and what happens if those people exercise. And I would maybe try and build up on some way like that. But I think it's important, whatever calculation we come up with, that it's not just a calculation, that we can actually explain fairly simply what it's trying to represent. And to be honest, I wouldn't be in favour of putting anything in the DP if we can only put it in as a calculation. I would want something that where we can explain the resulting information.
Can I ask Peter a question? So Peter, is your logic similar to the diluted EPS type thinking today? Were you looking at what's in the money and attributing to those and ignoring anti-dilutive?
Well, I think the problem with the diluted EPS today is it's that there's a kind of time series notion that's underlying it, which is looking at what was outstanding during the period and the sort of average during the period, and it's not really focusing so much on what's potentially dilutive at the end. So where things have expired, they're still included in the diluted EPS.
Yeah, but setting that aside, is it the sort of the in-the-moneyness logic that you're thinking about?
Well, I think that's one way. I think you could either do it that way and say what's currently in the money, or you could say what might come into the money and give them some allocation based on what they've got at the year end, based on the what exists at the year end.
Kumar?
Just to pick up on Sue's comment, just to clarify, I think if we look at intrinsic value, that is what is in the money. But if I've got to look at probably giving some indication of what could potentially come into money, that's a time value which adds up to the fair value computation. So that's where the challenge will come, because that's the only way I can give an indication of what could potentially come into the money. That's a time value computation in an option.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking so much necessarily trying to capture the time value, but doing more kind of more sort of deterministic calculation that says either one of two ways, either just the ones that are currently in the money, or look at the ones that could come into the money, but not do any kind of time value type calculation, but just assume they're converted in some way.
And then would you attribute to them based on the number of shares that would count?
Yeah, because ultimately when they are converted, they'll presumably be ranked.
So similar to diluted EPS logic, but used for attribution.
Yeah.
Maybe without the treasury share buyback assumptions in there.
Stephen?
But doesn't the current diluted earnings per share calculation effectively give the same answer as an attribution, but simply an attribution based upon the intrinsic value relative to the fair value of the shares?
But it's more of a time series calculation.
It's based on averages.
Yeah, and it's based on averages, and it's based on how long they're outstanding during the period rather than focusing on...
Yeah,
on
so,
the
so it's...
Set that aside for a moment.
And it's based
I
on
agree
P&L.
With you that there's that what's lacking at the moment is information about the year-end position, because if you're going to project and forecast, then the fact that you had an instrument outstanding for the first 3 months of the year, which affects diluted earnings per share, in terms of backward-looking, fine, I mean, I agree with where it's done, but in terms of being forward-looking and trying to establish what the impact is of these instruments on the future earnings attributable to the common shareholders or diluted earnings per share, you need year-end information, and that's lacking at the moment. But if you accept that we are reporting on a historical performance and there were some options outstanding for a part of the year, but I don't think there's anything wrong with diluted earnings per share, except the fact that effectively it produces an attribution based upon the intrinsic value of the warrant relative to the fair value of shares. And that seems odd to me, that we would deny the existence in effect of the time value when the time value can be so significant in economic terms on the position of the common shareholders. And that's why I think D is, I mean, you could do D as an adjustment to the diluted earnings per share. You could just base the diluted earnings per share on the fair value of the warrant rather than the intrinsic value. Or you can do D as an attribution. And the advantage of the attribution is then you have consistency with non-controlling interest and it all appears in one place. But my argument has always been that what we currently have in diluted earnings per share isn't enough because of this focus upon intrinsic value. Gary mentioned about, does this mean, does this have any impact on the earnings per share calculation? I think this is all tied in together. And to my mind, if you were to do D, then there's no point having, in addition, a diluted earnings per share as well, because it's substituting for the diluted earnings per share, and it would simplify accounting, I think, to get rid of the basic and the diluted earnings per share by having the attribution. What I was going to ask, though, is, I mean, I'm happy to have A, B, C, and D in the discussion paper, fine, you know, go through all the different arguments, because that's, you know, we're trying to get feedback on it. But I don't think we could do it without mentioning earnings per share.
Yeah.
Because to give the right context to this whole thing, I think you would have to explain what the current earnings per share does, and if we were to change all of this, what the implications would be on the earnings per share calculation.
But is it really wise in a discussion paper on such an incredibly complicated affair as this to come up with four different permutations?
Well, I prefer just to have D, but
I think we could cut it back from, well, if A is basically do nothing, we then have three that are more complicated, and I think we could reduce it to two. I think there are variants in there that we don't.
Or the way that Mary expressed it. Perhaps if we start off by what the objective is. I mean, what I've heard is, okay, there is some kind of desire to meet the needs of users. However, I guess people aren't convinced about which way on a cost-benefit basis might best meet those requirements. So we can just discuss in the discussion paper the alternatives by way of what the objective would be, what kind of information we'd be seeking to provide to users of financial information. Perhaps not go through all the details of calculations, etc., but just set out what the idea is with regards to whether we're focusing on profit or loss in the period, on the carrying amounts, or perhaps just disclosures with reference to the EPS calculations. If we just set it out that way, without really expressing our preliminary view, but just in terms of setting some kind of discussion up that we can get some more information about the potential costs and benefits of the approaches, would the board be happy with that approach?
I'm really a bit confused, man. Do we now changing this project and including earnings per share into this project, or?
No.
Yeah, because, but that is key for me, because otherwise I don't think why we should do that. Because
I think the consequences for earnings per share, I mean, we're going to, at some point in the future, we're going to have to think about implications for other standards. And at that point, we'll pick up the EPS.
But one question, if people would say, okay, maybe we prefer this kind of method D instead of doing earnings per share.
Yes.
Then what we are doing then?
Then we'd have to
require this allocation and not changing earnings per share, or do we do it in parallel?
We would have to make a decision. If we get that feedback, for instance, that approach D is the preference, you know, after we do the discussion paper and we get overwhelming feedback that approach D is the best approach, then we would have to have that discussion then and decide whether we'd
still have basic earnings per share. That wouldn't change. But if you were to do approach D, it would guarantee that earnings per share, that diluted earnings per share was always greater than the basic earnings per share. So it would always be anti-dilutive. So you would never disclose it. So
Stephen, I agree. That was my original question. Why is that additional information to earnings per share? Was my first question. But then I think we concluded maybe we're doing that, but then instead of diluted earnings per share. Or maybe I don't understand that. That is my question now. If we're doing that, I think we have then to include this earnings per share stuff.
I thought the suggestion, which I agreed with, was to help people understand how it all might fit together.
Yeah.
We could talk about, when we explained if approach D was in there, for example, how that then captures the effect of dilution, and therefore, as a consequence, we may think about whether we still needed a separate deletion. So just a touch, and also to explain, because Gary had the same question I had last time, if we were to do these attributions, does that mean that the basic earnings per share would look different as well? Just to confirm so people can understand the consequences of what they're looking at, right?
Yep.
How it all hangs together. But not talking about EPS and chapter and
verse. This isn't an EPS project, so we aren't going to go through the entire EPS standard to look through everything and see whether we want to make changes to those requirements. We might, as Mary suggested, when we go through and talk about disclosure, we may want to think about some additional disclosures that we might require as part of this project to alleviate some or to provide more information. But we aren't going to be reconsidering, for instance, IS 33 at this point. This is a discussion paper about clients. There is some interaction. Of course, there's some interaction because that's what EPS is trying to provide, but that isn't the objective of this project.
But really, I don't understand that, because my original question for this discussion was, what is the information value of this kind of information? And I said, because I think maybe it is a replacement of diluted earnings per share. But if it is not, what is the additional information value of that?
Well, Martin,
we conclude, okay, maybe it is an information value, but maybe that would replace diluted earnings per share. But then we're saying, but no, we don't discuss diluted earnings per share. So I'm confused.
Well,
I'm really confused.
Let me try maybe a slightly different answer to Martin's question. Martin, it sounds from the discussion we've had as if any exploration of B, C, or D, or using B, C, or D to illustrate a more general question, which should be framed by saying, right now there's a limited amount of information about dilution and the potential dilution effects that are delivered through the EPS calculations, which are presented as a disclosure. And one question is, really, we're exploring alternatives to that EPS disclosure only communication of this information. So depending upon what route we go, we may want to look at whether this supplants, makes redundant some of the EPS calculations, but we're not focused on this as a tuning of the EPS disclosure. We're asking whether we should be doing something different or not, and I think it's really only if we come to approach A, which is basically status quo, that we would look again at this. I mean, I think you're saying you can't have put this paper out there, which includes this discussion, without acknowledging its interaction with EPS and the fact that it repeats or moves into recognition and measurement some of the EPS stuff. But I think Manuel's trying to say, let's not turn this into an EPS project within the DP. I don't know, that's somewhere halfway in between, not just as a compromise, but not pretending it doesn't have any interaction with the EPS.
Totally convinced. Okay.